I'll be beginning from chapter 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes, and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south, and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. If you could now turn to page 675, I'll continue reading from verse 9. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. My son, beware of anything beyond these. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, with every secret thing, whether good or evil.
Thank you very much, Kate. And please keep Ecclesiastes open before you. And the challenge from last week was that you had to go reading the whole book. I don't know who was here last week and how many of the people who were here last week have undertaken the challenge. Should we do a show of hands, or would that be too embarrassing? Can I issue the challenge again? Basically, we're in Ecclesiastes for 4 weeks, and I think it's a book that has to be experienced as much as just heard snippets of. Even with a long reading like that, we'll have any chance for little bits of the 12 chapters. But I would love us to be submerged in it. And that's where I've been over the last week and a little bit before that earlier in the year when I was doing some work on it. I'd love it to be where we all were. So here's a challenge. Find time this week to read all of Ecclesiastes. And you'll find, as we did when we first read it at university in our Christian Union, at least when we first flicked through it, that it was a book full of comedy and great verses to be plucked out of context. It tells you, for example, the biblical precedent for voting for David Cameron, Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verse 2. Just check that one out. It gives you the biblical precedent for slacking off your college work if you're a student. That's Ecclesiastes 12, verse 12. You find that one? But if I were to pick just a key verse to summarise my experience of being in Ecclesiastes over the last weeks, if I were to summarise a key verse that summarised my experience of trying to prepare a sermon on Ecclesiastes, it would be Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 23. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? And the implied answer is, nobody can. Or at least nobody but the only wise God that we've been hearing about. I turned to the commentaries for some assistance. That's what you do if you're a preacher and you're stuck. You buy a commentary and you pull it off the shelf. It turns out that no commentary agrees on Ecclesiastes. They take diametrically opposing views of almost everything, what the book's for, if it's a good book or a bad book, a mistaken book or a hopeful book. They all disagree. But even worse than that, even two commentaries written by the same bloke disagree. He writes one, he was asked to update it for a second edition. He says at the beginning in the preface, slightly embarrassedly, this isn't exactly the same as my earlier attempt, and then takes diametrically the opposing view. It is a book you've got to experience, and it's a book that as you experience, frustrates you. I don't know how often it's been said in the St. Helens pulpit, but I do not really understand the book that I'm going to try and preach to you over the next 4 weeks. Can't make head or tail of it. I'll be open and confess that right up front. And I wonder if that's partly the point of it. It's a book that is supposed to vex us and frustrate us. It's a book that confronts us with some of the paradoxes of the world that we can't make sense of. It expresses some of the confusion of living in this world, even some of the confusion of living as a Christian in this world. And you'll see that just as the commentaries aren't very helpful, neither is my outline on the back of the notice sheet. That's about as far as I got with Ecclesiastes by the time the deadline came in on Friday for outlines. Hebel, the word Hebel is the word that comes 5 times in verse 2. And the Hebrew word, vanity. Hebel of Hebel, says the preacher. Hebel of Hebel, all is Hebel. And if the book's about anything, I'm pretty sure it's about this. It's about Hebel. It comes at the beginning of the book. It comes right at the end. If you just turn back to verse 8 of chapter 12. Right at the end of the book, the same thing, the summary of the preacher's message. Hebel of Hebel, says the preacher. All is Hebel. Everything is Hebel. I'm pretty sure about that. But what does that mean? Well, I want to suggest that the translations aren't necessarily the most helpful ones. The NIV, it's the translation I mostly use in my own quiet times, the New International Version, it says meaningless. We all thought that was very funny at university. Meaningless, meaningless, says the preacher. Everything is meaningless. We imagine him as a slightly grumpy fellow who went round kind of shaking his head and telling, no, it doesn't mean anything. But the book isn't meaningless. If everything is meaningless, what's the point of writing a book about it? What's the point of arranging the words of this book in any kind of order? You know, could you just scramble Ecclesiastes? Read every kind of third word. The, sun, vanity, vanity, all, does. You know, is that going to be as meaningful? No, of course it's much less meaningful. There's sentences and there's ideas and there's things that the writer says, I've come to understand. I perceived such and such, or I saw this or that, or I know that such. It's not without meaning. There are things to be said about this world. And of course that's true. Even when you're most confused or struggling to make head or tail of your circumstances, you would never say that they were just entirely random. You would never act entirely randomly, move your arms and limbs in random directions, say random sounds. There's some sense in things. It's not without meaning. Well, how about the ESV version? Here it is in front of us. Vanity. And the word vanity doesn't really mean without meaning. It kind of means without purpose. It's empty. It's not going anywhere. But that can't be true either. Because this is a book that goes somewhere, has an end in view. We heard the very end of the book read. The end of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, because God will bring every deed into judgment. There is a future judgment day when all of us give an answer to God. And so there is some kind of purpose to everything. And we find lots of reasons in Ecclesiastes. This is, God did this because of such and such, for some reason in mind. We see that some things are better than others. Light is better than darkness. Wisdom is better than folly. It's not entirely purposeless or vain. So what does this word mean? What does Ecclesiastes mean? It just means hebel. Well, the literal translation of the word is vapor or fog or mist. And that, I think, gets us much closer to what the preacher has perceived about this world that we live in. Not that there's nothing, but that what there is just like a fog. It's like if you wear glasses and you go from a cold outside to a warm and humid inside, and suddenly you can see nothing. Not quite nothing, just kind of grim, shadowy things. But you can't really make head or tail of them. Mist. And this book tells us lots of reasons for which the world we live in is a bit foggy, a bit difficult to understand. And I'm just going to try and give us a flavour of it this week, and then the weeks that follow we'll zoom in on some particular themes. We'll look at what he says about work, what he says about worshipping God in a world that's foggy. But firstly, just today, get our bearings on it. What is foggy or misty about this present world? Well, firstly, it's because the world is ephemeral. You can't keep it. It's one thing about fog. I don't know if you like fog. Probably you don't. Sometimes it looks slightly pretty, doesn't it, in the Peak District or in the Yorkshire Dales or something, that the fog lying in the valleys. But the one thing you can't do with fog is keep it. You can't rush out with a jam jar like we tried to do as kids and kind of store it. It just eludes you. It's there and then it's gone. And Ecclesiastes helps us to understand that in different kinds of ways. Firstly, he says things that are misty, they're ephemeral, that you can't keep them because everything just goes on in cycle after cycle after cycle after cycle after cycle. That's what we had in our reading just in chapter 1. The sun rises, the sun goes down. The sun rises, the sun goes down. The earth turns, it's daylight in London, it's daylight in Sydney. It's daylight in London, it's daylight in Sydney. It's day, it's night, it's day, it's night. Your alarm clock goes off, your alarm clock goes off, your alarm clock goes off. Everything just the same. You can't keep it, you can't get anywhere from it, you don't advance anywhere. I was trying to think of equivalents. He says, all streams, verse 7, run to the sea, but the sea is not full. The place where the streams flow, they flow again. It's just like the futile exercise that a young kid plays on the beach, isn't it? When you try and get a sieve or a bucket with a big hole in it, and you try and collect water. And the children run down to the beach, and it's kind of some distance because the tide's gone out, and they get down to the water and hurry up to try and fill the moat of their sandcastle. And by the time they get there, there's about that much water left. But they go down again for some more, and they come back, and there's that much water left, and they keep pouring it. And they pour it into the moat, but the moat's leaking because it's made of sand. And so by the time they get back, that's gone as well. And so they try for, you know, good, happy quarter of an hour to fill this moat with a holy bucket, and they say it again and again and again. You never get anywhere. It's like that with life, isn't it? How many times do you have to brush your teeth before they're clean for good? It's a whole dental industry based on this, isn't there? But I suppose we're not bored of brushing our teeth. If that was all you ever did in life, you'd be pretty boring. But we're not bored because of the other things that give variety to life, like eating. How many times do you have to eat before you're permanently full? Now, every day another meal to cook, another dish to wash, another, etc., another shop to go to buy some food to eat it, to wash the dishes, to buy the food to eat it, to wash the dishes. That could be pretty boring, couldn't it? But it's not boring because of some of the even bigger things. You know, like maybe you get married. So at a wedding yesterday. That's a big defining thing. But you know, you get the wedding registers, and there was a wedding the previous week and the previous week, and someone will get married, they'll get married, then they'll get married, someone will get married next Saturday, next Sunday, someone will get married, and so it goes on. Or you think, maybe I build something really unique, like the gherkin. You know, that's a one-off thing, isn't it? That'll be around for a little while. Yeah, just like when they built the Baltic Exchange, and it blew up, and they built a little Tudor house before that burnt down in the Fire of London, and they built a little shack before that that got blown away, and they say, let's have a big building project, let's have a big building project, let's have a big building project, and so it goes on and on and on and on and on. It doesn't get you anywhere. You can't keep it. It's there, but it's not containable. And that is what life can be like. The words come up again and again and again in Ecclesiastes. What is gained? Chapter 1, verse 3. What does a man gain? Or chapter 5, verse 15. As he came from his mother's wombs, he shall go again. Naked as he came, he shall take nothing for his toil. This is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there? You're born, you die. You're born, you die. What's the point of it? It's like mist. You can't store it. It's also like mist because it's unpredictable. And you can't control it. Now, so supposing you do like that view of the Yorkshire Dales where there's mist in the valleys, and you think that would be just the picture postcard view you wanted for your honeymoon or something, and you go there and it turns out that there's a rainstorm or something, or hail, or there's, you can't control mist. And Ecclesiastes says it's like that with life as well. Just look at chapter 3. Not so much cycles now as oscillations. Chapter 3, there's a time for everything. Verse 2, a time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant, a time to pluck up what's planted. A time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break, a time to build. A time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance. Do you notice they're opposites? The opposite thing. And you don't know which day it's going to be. Is today going to be a time of laughter or a time of mourning? It's been days you've woken up, aren't they, expecting it to be the happiest day, maybe a birthday. And there's been some terrible news and you've wept more tears that day than you can remember. For years. It's not just the cycles that everything's the same, it's the unpredictability. There's happy days and there's crying days. And how do you know which it will be? You can't predict it, just like mist. It's temporary. Mist is there for a day, then it's gone. Here 1 minute, gone the next. And life is like that, says Ecclesiastes. Did you know that Adam and Eve named their first son Hebel? I know we call it Abel, it's because someone wrote it slightly differently in the translation. It's the same word, actually. It's the Ecclesiastes word. Not meaningless, that'd be a weird name for a son. But fleeting. Maybe they knew in some kind of divine nudging as they chose the name. He'd only be there for a little while. Before his son murdered him as a young man, he was gone. Just there for a day, gone tomorrow. Ecclesiastes would explore that, the way that death makes a mockery of everything we do. You can achieve something, you can learn something, then you die. What's the point of learning A-level chemistry when in 100 years' time you'll be dead and your corpse will not be able to tell you any equations at all? What's the point? What's the point of enjoying a ticket to the opera? When in 100 years' time you'll be dead, you won't even remember. What's the point? Because it's so temporary. What's the point? Because you don't know what comes afterwards. Who could predict your grandson's life, even? Who could have predicted in 1900 what would happen in the year 2000? Who can know? It's quite a comedy, isn't it? The sci-fi films predicting the year 2000 that were made in the 1970s. And we all, you know, it's not very much like that at all. You can't tell what will become after. And so the Ecclesiastes keeps asking, what's next? Chapter 3, verse 22. He says, who can bring him to see what will be after him? Chapter 5, verse 12. That's not right. I apologise. I won't try and find it. chapter 7, verse 14. Men may not find out anything that will be after him. So it's chapter 6, verse 12. Who can tell what will be after him? You don't know what's next. Missed a day today, sunny day tomorrow. It's ephemeral. Nothing can be gained. It's unpredictable. You can't control it. It's temporary. You can't see beyond it. It's paradoxical. This is the blurry glasses one. You can't see clearly through it. You cannot see clearly through the mist. So chapter 3, verse 11. God has put eternity in man's heart, but so he cannot find out. He cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. Chapter 6, verse 10. Whatever has come has already been named. It's known to what man is, and he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he, with wisdom or knowledge. Or my favourite verse, I said in my heart, I'll be wise, but it was beyond me. It's paradoxical. And then you add together ephemeral, unpredictable, temporary, and paradoxical, and you admit this is a pretty good fit for our lives much of the time. And then you experience vexation. Drives you crazy. Let me tell you, it drives you crazy. I've been in this book much of the week and not getting much further at the end of another day's preparation of it. Round and round you go. You can't make head or tail of it. And Ecclesiastes captures this in this little double entendre. In Hebrew he says it's re'ut ruach, which means in our translation a chasing after the wind. But those of you who've been on the RML Mark weekends away know that the word ruach for wind also means spirit. And the word for chasing can also mean vexation. It's a chasing after wind. It's a vexation of your spirit. And of course, you don't have to chase wind very long to know how frustrating that can be. Nothing is to be gained. Nothing can be seen clearly. Nothing will last. Nothing can be kept. And it drives you nearly mad. And isn't it amazing to have in the Bible a book that's so honest? Rightly, as Christians, we get excited that God is wise and that he reveals the truth to us. And of course he does. The Bible is full of revelation. As we look in future weeks, we'll see that Ecclesiastes is full of revelation as well from God. There's many things that God has made known to us. He's made known his design as creator, why he made this world. He's made known to us his final intentions as judge, to call every one of us to account. He's made known to us how we can know him as our creator, how we can enjoy gifts from him as our provider. All of these things in Ecclesiastes, lots that we can know. But Ecclesiastes says, look, be honest, there's even more that you don't know. There's things about your life that you can't get to the bottom of, that you can't keep, you can't understand, you can't see through. It's a fog. Now, that's what it says. Finally, in our last few minutes, what's it for? What's the point? Now, I actually asked William, the rector, if I could preach on this. Can you believe that? Earlier in the year, I said, I'd really like to have a go at Ecclesiastes. He said, okay. Boy, did I regret that later on. What's it for? What's the point of describing from the pulpit to you all the things about your life that you don't get, apart from that you know there's a book in the Bible that understands? What is the point? Well, here's two stabs at it. Here's the point for a non-Christian. I don't think this actually is Ecclesiastes' point at all, actually, but let's just use it that way. Ask your non-Christian friend what they live for, and plug it into Ecclesiastes. What's the point of your existence? Maybe they say, have you seen the adverts for the atheist summer camps? We're talking about Christian camps, and they started their own ones now. I don't know what you do differently. I mean, you know, you play sports same as we do, and then what do you say? And we don't believe in God. That's interesting. But the atheist summer camps, what's life for, though? Well, maybe for learning stuff. Maybe you learn science. Okay, that's interesting. And where does that get you when you're dead? Oh, well, nowhere, but then I pass on my sights to the next person. Okay, well, where does it get them when they're dead? Well, they pass it on to the next person, and so you keep passing on, except the atheists believe that eventually the earth is going to, the sun will die and the earth will crash into it and it will all become supernova and then it will just evolve and evolve. And what's the point then? Why does it matter how advanced this little planet got for the millions of years before it was nothing again, forever? What's the point? Or maybe they live for pleasure. Well, pleasure's all very good, Ecclesiastes understands. That pleasure's more fun than sorrow. But where does it get you in the end, when you die? And what then? It's very good at reality checks, this book. It'd be great to plug your own life into, but also great to plug in your friend's life. What do you live for? You know, it turns out, I was saying to Charlie and William, you know, I don't think it is that depressing a book, actually, as we go on in future weeks. There's quite a lot of optimism there. We haven't got much of it today. There's quite a lot there. But, you know, all of the optimistic things about Ecclesiastes are things about God. If you take those away, well, then you really are, in your vexation, close to despair. So get a friend to read it with you in the office. You know, what are you reading this lunchtime? Come and join me. They'll be pretty surprised. I tell you, their eyes will boggle when they find out this stuff's in the Bible. But you say, this is a pretty depressing book, but you're not even allowed to believe any of the bits about God. All the sentences with God in, I want to take away from your version. Well, then there's nothing left to hope in. Really nothing. But ultimately, I don't think it is a book primarily addressed to the non-Christian. Some people have tried to kind of set Ecclesiastes, the bloke who's kind of collecting all these sayings, over and against the editor. So the editor introduces him in the first verse of the book. Here are the words of the preacher, over to him. And then he takes centre stage and tells you that everything's missed, everything's vapid, everything's missed. And then the editor comes back at the end, chapter 12, and says, well, look, you've heard all kinds of stuff from the preacher now. Some people have tried to say that the editor is telling us the orthodox stuff about God, whereas the preacher's got it all wrong. So they try and say, here's a guy who's just way too pessimistic. But then finally we get set straight at the end by the editor who comes back in. I do think that's right, though. Now, what the editor says about the preacher. Besides being wise, he says he's wise. The preacher is at the end of the book. Besides being wise, the preacher taught the people knowledge. The preacher sought to find words of delight. Uprightly, he wrote words of truth. He's saying, the editor's saying, he got it right, guys. He wrote what's true and what's wise. Listen to him. Be a good idea. And the editor summarizes some of the Christian stuff about God. Fear God. God's going to judge everyone. God's your creator. Actually, they're all things that the preacher said as well. It's not an atheist book. It's a Christian book. And the point is that for a Christian, life is often like fog or like mist. It's not that there's nothing. The world is not meaningless. We know that, don't we? The world is not without purpose. It's not pointless. There is a saviour, a creator, a judge, a relationship with a God who gives us things, who makes things for our enjoyment, who wants us to know him. But sometimes with all that, you still can't quite understand. You can't get it. You can't see to the bottom of it. And you're frustrated to the point of despair. You see, if your Christianity is only based on everything making sense all the time, what are you going to do when something comes along that you don't get? Why did that pastor get cancer? Why did that lovely family lose their baby? Why did God make me redundant just now that I got the perfect job that enabled me to serve him? Won't make sense. And if your faith in God is only for the scenes when everything makes sense, you'll throw it out the window. But how about when, like the preacher, you get to the bottom of things and you say, look, there's much that's fog. But I know that God's creator. I know he's my judge. I know he's good in the things he gives me. I know that relationship with him through Jesus is what makes life worth living. Think about a foggy night. It's not that you can't see anything. You're driving along in your car. It's not that you can't see anything through the window. You just can't see all that much. You can see the lights of the cars coming the other way, hopefully. You can see the cat's eyes. You can see mercifully when you get too close to the corner, those stripy triangle things that tell you to turn around. But you don't see very much. You see just enough to keep going in a straight line down the road. And that's what Ecclesiastes is saying to us about our life. Much you don't get, much you won't understand, much that will frustrate and vex you. But keep the cat's eyes in your eyes. Keep straight ahead. And don't drive too fast, too cockily, too smugly, too confidently. He'll say a little bit later on, God is in heaven and you are on earth. God is the all-wise. We're not very wise. I just want to read you a couple of verses from the New Testament and we'll close. This is what James says in his letter. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a town, spend a year there, trade and make profit. Yet you don't know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we'll live and do this or that. God is wise. We're not always wise. Much is a fog, but keep trusting him. Keep fearing him. Keep driving ahead with your eyes on the road, with just enough light from the cat's eyes to keep going. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this extraordinary book. Father, thank you for the way that it doesn't just tell us things, we experience it. I've experienced it as I've been reading. We've experienced it together this evening. Thank you that it's such a close fit for much of our lives, what we see around us. And thank you, Father, that in a world that's confusing, it is not hopeless or meaningless. Thank you for those truths that we can hold on to at the darkest of times, that you are our good creator, our final judge, and through Jesus Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And through him, you are our Father. We pray, Father, this book will continue to do us good this week, next week, and keep us trusting you in those seasons of life when things just don't make sense. For Jesus' sake, amen.